sympathetic to Russia, it was never something that she shared with me. You have always known, Mr. President, that the Sons of Jihad attacked Western institutions. We oppose the influence of the West in Southeastern Europe. Of course, this is consistent with the Russian agenda. But this does not mean that we work for the Russians. My understanding is that, yes, Suleiman is accepting money from the Russians in the past, but he no longer needs their money. He sells his services to the highest bidder, I say. He does whatever he wants. Not always for money, he answers to no man but himself. That's how our intelligence has understood it, too. That's how Nina was injured, I say. That shrapnel in her head. She said a missile struck close to a church. It was the Georgians. It must have been. Augie's eyes trail away, looking off into the distance, filling with tears. Does it really matter? He whispers. It matters if she was working with the Russians, Augie. If I can figure out who's behind this, I have more options at my disposal. Augie nods, still looking off in the distance. Threats. Deterrence. Mr. President, if we cannot stop this virus, your threats will be empty. Your attempts at deterrence will mean nothing. But the virus hasn't hit yet. We are still the most powerful country in the world. Maybe it's time I reminded Russia of that fact. Augie returns to the basement. I pull out my phone and dial Carolyn. Carrie, I say, are the Joint Chiefs in the Situation Room?
Yes, sir.
I'll be on in 2 minutes, I say. Chapter 58. Mr. President, says Chancellor Richter with his usual regal formality as he shoots the French cuffs on his shirt, I require no convincing of the Russians' involvement in this attack. As you know, Germany has experienced several such incidents in our recent past. The Bundestag affair, the CDU headquarters. We are still experiencing the effects today. He's referring to the 2015 hacking into the servers of the German Bundestag, the lower house of the federal legislature. The hackers scooped up emails and loads of sensitive information before the Germans finally detected it and patched it up. Leaks of that information continue to spill out on the Internet, strategic drip by strategic drip to this day. And the headquarters of Germany's Christian Democratic Union Party, Chancellor Richter's party, was hacked as well, involving the theft of many documents containing sensitive and sometimes blunt exchanges on topics of political strategy, campaign coordination, and key issues. Both these attacks have been attributed to a group of cyber terrorist hackers known as APT-28, or Fancy Bear, affiliated with the GRU, Russia's military intelligence service. We are aware of approximately 75 attempted cyber terrorist incidents since Bundestag and CDU, says Richter's aide, Dieter Kohl, Germany's top foreign intelligence officer. I speak of phishing expeditions into the servers belonging to federal and local governments and various political parties, all of them hostile to the Kremlin. I speak of incidents involving government institutions, industry, labor, unions, think tanks, all of them, he says, attributed to Fancy Bear. Much of the information they have. Chancellor Richter turns to his colleague, searching for the right word. Exfiltrated, yes. Much of the information they have exfiltrated has not yet been leaked. If we are expecting, as the election season approaches, to be seeing it, so, Mr. President, I can say to you, Germany requires no convincing on the question of whether the Russians are involved.
But this is different, says Prime Minister Neubauer. If I am right about the virus you detected on the Pentagon server, there were no breadcrumbs, I believe you'd say.
Correct, I say. This time the hackers didn't leave behind any trace. No fingerprints, no breadcrumbs. It just showed up out of nowhere and disappeared without a trace.
And that is not the only difference, she continues. Your concern, Johnny, is not the theft of information. Your concern is the stability of your infrastructure.
It's both, I say. But you're correct, Noya. I'm worried that they're attacking our systems. The place where the virus showed up when it winked at us before disappearing is part of our operational infrastructure. They aren't stealing emails. They're compromising our systems. And I am told, says Chancellor Richter, that if anyone can do it, it is the Sons of Jihad. Our people. He looks at his foreign intelligence chief, who nods. They tell us the SOJ is the best in the world. One would think that we could find people just as competent. But what we are learning is no. In fact, there are very few elite cyber terrorists, and just as few, if not fewer, elite cyber defense experts. In our country, we have formed a new cyber command, but we are having trouble filling the positions. We have maybe a dozen, more or less, who would qualify as good enough to defend against most able cyber terrorists. It's like anything else, I say. Sports, the arts, academia. There are some people at the very top of the pyramid who are simply more skilled than everyone else. Israel has many of them on the defense side. Israel has the best cyber defense systems in the world. I nod to Noya, who accepts the compliment without objection. It is a source of pride for the Israelis.
And if Israel plays the best defense, says Richter, Russia plays the best offense.
But now we have Augie. Richter nods, his eyes narrowing. Noya looks at Richter, then at me.
And you are confident you can trust this man, this Augustus Kozlenko?
Noya, I open my hands. I'm confident that I have no other choice but to trust him. Our people can't unlock this thing. They can't even find it. I sit back in my chair. He tipped us off to it. If it weren't for him, we wouldn't even know about it.
So he says.
So he says, I concede. True. Look, whoever is ultimately behind this, the SOJ or Russia or someone else, yes, they may have sent Augie to me. He may have some ulterior motive. I've been waiting to hear it. I've been waiting for some demand, some ransom. I'm not hearing it. And remember, they tried to kill him. Twice. So for my money, he's a threat to them, which means he's an asset to us. I have my best people, and your best people, and Jorgen's best people, watching every move he makes downstairs, listening and learning and probing. We even have a camera on the room, just to keep an eye on him. I throw up my hands. If anyone has a better idea, I'm open to it. Otherwise, this is the best thing I can do to try to avoid. My words trail off. I can't bring myself to say them. To avoid what? Asked Richter. Do we have a sense of the possible harm? We can all speculate. We can all conjure up nightmare scenarios. What does the boy say? It's a good segue. One of the principal reasons I've asked the German Chancellor here today. I turn to Alex, standing in the far corner of the room. Alex, bring Augie up here, I say. You all should hear this for yourselves. Chapter 59. Augie stands before the world leaders, present in the living room, fatigued and frazzled, wearing ill-fitting clothes we found for him after a shower, overwhelmed in every way by the events of the last 12 hours. Yet this young man seems not even slightly fazed by the company he is keeping. They are men and women of tremendous accomplishments, with incredible power at their fingertips. But in this arena, he is the teacher and we are the pupils.
One of the great ironies of the modern age, he begins, is that the advancements of mankind can make us more powerful and yet more vulnerable at the same time. The greater the power, the greater the vulnerability. You think, rightly so, that you are at the apex of your power, that you can do more things than ever before. But I see you at the peak of your vulnerability. The reason is reliance. Our society has become completely reliant on technology. The Internet of Things, you are familiar with this concept?
More or less, I say, the connection of devices to the Internet.
Yes, essentially. And not just laptop computers and smartphones. Anything with a power switch. Washing machines, coffee makers, DVRs, digital cameras, thermostats, machine components, jet engines. The list of things large and small is almost endless. 2 years ago, there were 15 billion devices connected to the Internet. 2 years from now, I have read estimates that the number will be 50 billion. I have heard 100 billion. The layperson can hardly turn on a television anymore without seeing a commercial about the latest smart device, how it will do something you never would have thought possible 20 years ago.
It will order flowers for you. It will let you see someone standing outside the front door of your home while you are at work. It will tell you if there is road construction up ahead and a faster route to your destination. And all that connectivity makes us more vulnerable to malware and spyware, I say. We understand that. But I'm not so concerned at the moment about whether Siri will tell me the weather in Buenos Aires or whether some foreign nation is spying on me through my toaster. Augie moves about the room as if lecturing on a large stage to an audience of thousands.
No, but I have digressed. More to the point, nearly every sophisticated form of automation, nearly every transaction in the modern world, relies on the Internet. Let me say it like this. We depend on the power grid for electricity, do we not?
Of course.
And without electricity, it would be chaos. Why?
He looks at each of us, awaiting an answer.
Because there's no substitute for electricity, I say. Not really.
He points at me.
Correct! Because we are so reliant on something that has no substitute.
And the same is now true of the Internet, says Noya, as much to herself as to anyone else.
Augie bows slightly.
Most assuredly, Madam Prime Minister. A whole host of functions that were once performed without the Internet now can only be performed with the Internet. There is no fallback, not anymore. And you are correct. The world will not collapse if we cannot ask our smartphones what the capital of Indonesia is. The world will not collapse if our microwave ovens stop heating up our breakfast burritos or if our DVRs stop working.
Augie paces a bit, looking down, hands in his pockets, every bit the professor in mid-lecture.
But what if everything stopped working, he says.
The room goes silent. Chancellor Richter, raising a cup of coffee to his lips, freezes midstream. Noya looks like she's holding her breath.
Dark ages, I think to myself.
But the Internet is not as vulnerable as you are saying, says Dieter Kohl, who may not be Augie's equal on these matters, but is far more knowledgeable than any of the elected officials in the room. A server may become compromised, slowing or even blocking traffic, but then another one is used. The traffic routes are dynamic. But what if every route were compromised? Augie asks.
Kohl works that over, his mouth pursed as if about to speak, suspended in that position. He closes his eyes and shakes his head.
How would that be possible?
It would be possible with time, patience, and skill, says Augie.
If the virus was not detected when it infiltrated the server, and if it stayed dormant after infiltration, how did you infiltrate the surface? phishing attacks?
Augie makes a face as if insulted.
On occasion. But primarily, no. Primarily, we used misdirection. DDoS attacks. Corruption of the BGP tables.
Augie, I say.
Oh, yes, I apologize. Speak English, you said. Very well. A DDoS attack is a distributed denial-of-service attack, a flood attack, essentially, on a network of servers that convert the URL addresses we type into our browsers into IP numbers that internet routers use.
Augie, I say again. He smiles in apology.
Here, you type in www.cnn.com, but the network converts it to a routing number to direct traffic. A flood attack sends bogus traffic to the network and overwhelms it, so the network stalls or crashes. In October of 2016, a DDoS attack shut down many services and thus many prominent websites in America for nearly an entire day. Twitter, PlayStation, CNN, Spotify, Verizon, Comcast, not to mention thousands of online retail operations were all disrupted. And then, the corruption of the BGP tables, the Border Gateway Protocol tables, the service providers such as, for example, AT&T, they will essentially advertise on those tables who their clients are. If company ABC uses AT&T for internet service, then AT&T will advertise on those tables. If you want to access company ABC's website, go through us. Let's say you're in China, for example, using Velitel, and you want to access company ABC's website. You will have to hop from Velitel to NTT in Japan and then hop to AT&T in America. The BGP tables tell you the path. We, of course, just type in a website or click on a link. But often what is happening, almost instantaneously, is a series of hops across internet service providers using the BGP tables as a map. The problem is that these BGP tables are set up on trust. You may recall that several years ago, Velitel, called Chinatel at the time, claimed one day that it was the final hop for traffic to the Pentagon. And thus, for some period of time, a good portion of internet traffic intended for the Pentagon was routed through China. I know about it now, but I wasn't aware of it then. I was just the governor of North Carolina back then, simpler times. The understatement of the century. A sophisticated hacker, says Augie, could invade the BGP tables at the top 20 internet service providers around the world, scramble the tables, and thus misdirect traffic. It would be the same effect as a DDoS attack. It would temporarily shut down internet service to anyone served by that provider.
But how does that relate to the installation of the virus? Asked Noya. The object of a DDoS attack, as I understand it, is to shut down internet service to a provider.
Yes.
And it sounds as if this scrambling of the BGP tables has the same effect.
Yes. And, as you can imagine, it is very serious. A service provider cannot afford to lose service to its customers. That is the whole reason for existence. It must act immediately to fix the problem, or it will lose its customers and go out of business.
Of course, says Noya.
As I said before, misdirection. Augie waves a hand. We used the BGP tables and the DDoS attacks as platforms to invade the servers.
Noya raises her chin, getting it now.
Augie had to explain all this to me more than once.
So while they were focusing on that emergency, you snuck in and planted the virus.
An accurate enough summary, yes. Augie cannot help but beam with pride. And because the virus was dormant, because it was hidden and performed no malicious function, they never noticed.
Dormant for how long? Asked Dieter Cole.
Years. I believe we started,
he looks upward, squints.
3 years ago.
The virus has been lying dormant for 3 years.
In some cases, yes. And you've infected how many servers?
Augie takes a breath, a child prepared to deliver bad news to his parents.
The virus is programmed to infect every node, every device that receives internet service from the provider.
And? Cole pauses as if afraid to probe further, afraid to open the door to the dark closet to find out what's hidden inside.
Approximately, how many internet service providers did you infect?
Approximately. Augie shrugs his shoulders. All of them, he says. Everyone wilts under the news. Richter, unable to sit still, rises from his chair and leans against the wall, folding his arms. Noya whispers something to her aide.
People of great power feeling powerless.
If you have infected every internet service provider in the country, and those providers have in turn passed on the virus to every client, every node, every device, that means...
Dieter Cole falls back in his chair.
We have infected virtually every device that uses the internet in the United States.
The Prime Minister and Chancellor both look at me, each turning pale. The attack we are discussing is on America, but they know full well that their countries could be next. Which is part of the reason I wanted Augie to explain this to them.
Just the United States?
Chancellor Richter asks, the internet connects the entire world.
A fair point, says Augie. We targeted only the ISPs in the United States. No doubt there will be some transfer to other countries as data from American devices is sent abroad. There is no way to know for certain, but we wouldn't expect the spread to be significant. We were focusing on the United States. The goal was to cripple the United States.
This is far broader than our worst fears. When the virus peaked at us, it was on a Pentagon server. We all thought military, or government at least. But Augie is telling us it goes far, far beyond government usage. It will affect every industry, countless aspects of daily life, every household, all facets of our lives.
What you are telling us, says Chancellor Richter, his voice shaky, is that you are going to steal the internet from America.
Augie looks at Richter, then at me.
Yes, but that's just the beginning, I say. Augie, tell them what the virus will do.
Chapter 60.
The virus is essentially what you'd call a wiper virus, says Augie. As the name suggests, a wiper attack wipes out all software on a device. Your laptop computers will be useful only as doorstops. Your routers as paperweights. Their servers will be erased. You will have no internet service. That is surely true. But your devices will not work either.
Dark Ages.
Augie picks up an apple out of the fruit bowl and tosses it in his hand. Most viruses and attack codes are designed to infiltrate surreptitiously and steal data, he explains. Think of a burglar who sneaks in through a window and tiptoes quietly through a house. He wants to get in and out without detection. And if the theft is ever detected, it's too late.
Wiper attacks, on the other hand, are noisy. They want you to know what they're doing. There's no reason to hide, because they want something from you. They are essentially, well, not essentially, they are actually holding the contents of your device hostage. Pay the ransom or say goodbye to all your files.
Of course, They have no particular desire to delete all your data. They just want your money.
He opened his hand.
Well, our virus is a silent wiper attack.
We have entered quietly and infiltrated to the maximum extent possible. But we do not want ransom. We want to delete all your files.
And backup files are no help, says Dieter Kohl, shaking his head, because you have infected them as well.
Of course, the virus has been uploaded onto the backup files by the very act of backing up the systems on a routine basis.
They're time bombs, I say. They've been hiding inside devices waiting for the moment they're called into action.
Yes.
And that day is today.
We look around the room at one another. I've had a couple of hours to digest this, having had all this explained to me by Augie on Marine One. I was probably wearing the same holy shit expression on that helicopter that all of them are wearing right now.
So, you appreciate the consequences, says Augie.
50 years ago, you had typewriters and carbon paper. Now you only have computers. 50 years ago, in most cases, 10 or 15 years ago, you didn't rely on connectivity to run so many of your operations. But now you do. It is the only way you operate. Take it away and there is no fallback.
The room is quiet. Augie looks down at his shoes, maybe out of respect for the grieving or maybe out of apology. What he is describing is something that he had a big hand in creating.
Give us an idea of... Noya Barum rubs her temples.
Oh, well, Augie begins to stroll around again. The examples are limitless. Small examples. Elevators stop working. Grocery store scanners. Train and bus passes. Televisions. Phones. Radios. Traffic lights. Credit card scanners. Home alarm systems. Laptop computers will lose all their software. All files. Everything erased. Your computer will be nothing but a keyboard and a blank screen.
Electricity will be severely compromised, which means refrigerators. In some cases, heat. Water? Well, we have already seen the effect on water purification plants. Clean water in America will quickly become a scarcity.
That means health problems on a massive scale. Who will care for the sick? Hospitals. Will they have the necessary resources to treat you? Surgical operations these days are highly computerized, and they will not have access to any of your prior medical records online. For that matter, will they treat you at all? Do you have health insurance?
Says who? A card in your pocket?
They won't be able to look you up and confirm it, nor will they be able to seek reimbursement from the insurer. And even if they could get in contact with the insurance company won't know whether you're its customer.
Does it have a handwritten list of its policyholders?
No. It's all on computers.
Computers that have been erased.
Will the hospitals work for free?
No websites, of course. No e-commerce. Conveyor belts. Sophisticated machinery inside manufacturing plants. Payroll records. Planes will be grounded. Even trains may not operate in most places. Cars, at least any built since 2010 or so, will be affected.
Legal records, welfare records, law enforcement databases. The ability of local police to identify criminals, to coordinate with other states and the federal government through databases. No more. Bank records. You think you have $10,000 in your savings account? $50,000 in a retirement account? You think you have a pension that allows you to receive a fixed payment every month?
He shakes his head.
Not if computer files and their backups are erased.
Do banks have a large wad of cash wrapped in a rubber band
with your name on it, sitting in a vault somewhere? Of course not. It's all data.
Mother of God, says Chancellor Richter, wiping his face with a handkerchief.
Surely, Augie continues, banks were some of the first companies to realize their vulnerability and to segregate some of their records onto separate systems. But we had already infected them. That was the first industry we targeted. So their segregated networks are just as compromised. The financial markets, there are no longer trading floors. It is all electronic. All trading through American exchanges will stop. Government functions, of course. The government depends on the collection of revenue. The tax rolls for income tax. The collection of sales taxes, excise taxes, and the like. All of it gone. Where will the government get the money to function, to the extent it can function? The flow of currency will be suddenly reduced to hand-to-hand transactions in cash. And cash from where? You will not be able to go to your local bank or your nearest ATM and withdraw cash, because the bank has no record of you. The economy in this country was screeched to a halt. Entire industrial sectors dependent exclusively on the Internet will have no means of surviving. The others will be severely compromised. The impact will inevitably lead to massive unemployment, an enormous reduction in the availability of credit. A recession the likes of which would make your depression in the 1930s look like a momentary hiccup. Panic, he says. Widespread panic. A run on the banks. Looting of grocery stores. Rioting. Massive crime. The outbreak of diseases. All semblance of civil order gone. And I have not even mentioned military and national security capabilities. Your ability to track terrorists. Your surveillance capabilities. Your highly sophisticated Air Force will be grounded. Your missile launching capability? No more. Radar and sonar? The high-tech telecommunications capabilities in your military? Gone. The United States will be vulnerable to attack in ways it has never seen before, he says. Your military defenses will be at 19th century levels against enemies with 21st century capabilities. Like Russia and China and North Korea. Dieter Kohl raises a hand. If the Internet were permanently taken down, then it would be a catastrophe of epic proportions. But these problems would be fixed. It is not as if America would forever lose the Internet.
Augie nods, bows slightly.
You are correct, sir. That Internet capability would eventually be restored. It would probably take months to rebuild the entire network, from the Internet service providers all the way down to the end-use devices, all of whose systems, at every step of the chain, will have been destroyed completely. During that time, the United States will be vulnerable to a military attack or a terrorist strike as never before. During that time, entire sectors of the economy, heavily, if not exclusively, reliant on the Internet, will be destroyed. During that time, desperately sick people will not receive their treatments or their medical procedures. Every company, every bank, every hospital, every government office, every individual will have to buy new devices because their old ones were destroyed. How long can the entire country go without clean drinking water, without electricity, without refrigeration, without the ability to perform vital medical procedures and surgeries? Surely the United States would focus first on such critical needs and services. But how quickly could it restore even those things to a country of 300 million people? Certainly not within a week,
not to the entire country. 2 weeks? Several months more likely? The death toll, I should think, would be staggering. And even when internet service is eventually restored, consider the damage that would be irreparable. Everyone in America will have lost all their savings, all their investments, all those records permanently erased. They will be utterly penniless, except for the cash they happen to have on them when the virus struck. The same is true for their pensions, their health insurance, their welfare and social security benefits, their medical records. That data will never be recovered. Or, if it were somehow recovered, without electronic data, it would be an imperfect, unverifiable process, and it would take years. Years. How long can a person go without money? And if people do not have money, how can any sector of the economy remain viable? Not a single store on any street in this country, from your Fifth Avenues and your magnificent miles and your Rodeo drives down to the smallest stores in the smallest towns, how can any of them exist without customers? To say nothing of the internet-based sectors of the industry, there will be nothing, absolutely nothing, left of the American economy. Great God, Chancellor Richter mumbles. It's much worse than I had imagined. It's worse than anyone could imagine, says Augie. The United States of America will become the largest third world country on Earth.
Chapter 61. Augie leaves my two guests, Prime Minister Noya Baram and Chancellor Jürgen Richter, dazed and silenced. Richter removes his suit jacket, revealing his vest, and again wipes his forehead with a handkerchief. Noya serves herself a large glass of water.
Why? Richter brings a hand to his chin, rubbing it. Why would Russia do this?
If it's Russia, I think to myself.
Is it not obvious,
asks Noya Baram after a long drink of water, dabbing her lips with a napkin.
To me, it is not. Is there a military component here? If America's military capabilities are compromised, if our infrastructure is in tatters, does that make the United States vulnerable to a military attack? It cannot be, can it? Russia would attack the United States? Surely.
He waves his hand.
Surely, the United States. Perhaps she would be momentarily vulnerable, yes, but surely America would rebuild her might, and then, of course, there is Article 5.
Under Article 5 of the North Atlantic Treaty, an attack on one NATO nation is an attack on all. An attack on the United States could trigger a world war. Theoretically, at least, that doctrine has never been put to the ultimate test. If Russia disabled our military infrastructure and followed it up by hitting us with nuclear weapons, would our nuclear NATO members, Germany, for example, or the UK or France, respond in kind against Russia? It would test our alliance as never before. Each one of those countries, should it do so, would be guaranteed a retaliatory nuclear strike. That's why it's so important for Richter to realize that Germany could be next, that he can't let Russia, or whoever is responsible, get away with this.
But who is Russia's greatest impediment? Noya asked. Whom does Russia fear the most?
NATO, says Richter.
Noya's shoulders rise.
Well, yes. Yes, Jürgen. Yes, NATO's expansion to the borders of Russia is of great concern to them. But in Russia's eyes, and of course I mean no disrespect, Jürgen, but in Russia's eyes, when it sees NATO, it sees America. America first and foremost, and then its allies.
So what does Russia gain? I get out of my chair, unable to sit still. I can understand Russia wanting to disable us, to set us back, to leave us wounded, but destroy us?
Johnny, says Noya, setting down her water, during the Cold War, the United States, you always believed that the Soviets wanted to destroy you, and they assumed the same of you. A lot has changed over the last 25, 30 years. The Soviet Empire collapsed. Russia's military degraded. NATO expanded to Russia's borders. But has anything really changed? Russia feels as threatened by you as ever. Ultimately, given the chance, do you not think it would be a viable option once more? Are you willing to risk being wrong?
Her head tilting to the side, a heavy sigh released, she says,
you have no choice but to prepare for the possibility of a direct strike on America.
It's almost unfathomable. Almost. But my job is to prepare for the worst, even as I work for the best. And anyone who thinks he fully understands President Chernikov is mistaken. The man plays a long game. But that doesn't mean he wouldn't take a shortcut if he could. Chancellor Richter checks his watch.
We are still one delegation short, he says. I would have thought they'd be here by now.
They have a few things on their minds, I say. Alex Trimble walks into the room. I turn to him.
They've arrived, Mr. President, he says. The Russians are here.
Chapter 62. The convoy of black SUVs pulls into the driveway. Russian security agents emerge from the first SUV, conferring with Jacobson and others from Secret Service. I stand ready to receive them, one thought dominating all others. This is how wars begin. I asked President Chernikov to attend our summit at the same time I reached out to Israel and Germany. I didn't know of Russia's involvement at the time. I still don't. Not for certain, but that country has the best cyber terrorists in the world, and if they aren't behind this, then they can help. And they have just as much to fear as we do. If the United States is vulnerable, so is everybody else, including Russia. And if Russia is behind this, it still makes sense to have the country represented here. When Sun Tzu said, keep your friends close and your enemies closer, he had a point. But it was also a test. If Russia was behind Dark Ages, I didn't think President Chernikov would be willing to come and sit with me while this virus detonated and spread mass destruction in its wake. He would send someone in his stead, for appearance's sake. The Russian agents open the rear door of the second SUV. One official steps out, Prime Minister Ivan Volkov, Chernikov's handpicked second-in-command, a former colonel in the Red Army. To some, the butcher of Crimea, the military leader behind suspected war crimes in Chechnya, Crimea, and later Ukraine, from the rape and murder of innocent civilians to the merciless torture of POWs and the suspected use of chemical weapons. He is built like a stack of bricks, short and solid, his hair cut so tight that only a small strip of dark hair on top of his head is visible, almost like a mohawk. He is near 60 but physically fit, a former boxer who spends time every day in the gym, as far as we understand, with sharp wrinkles on his prominent forehead and a flat nose that has been broken more than once in the ring. Mr. Prime Minister, I say, standing along the driveway, my hand extended. Mr. President. His expression implacable, his dark eyes peering into mine, he shakes my hand with an iron grip. He is dressed in a black suit and a tie that is a solid blue on the top half, red on the bottom, two-thirds of the Russian flag. I was disappointed that President Chernikov could not come personally. I was more than disappointed.
As is he, Mr. President. He has been ill for several days. Nothing serious, but he was not available to travel. I can assure you that I speak with his full authority. And the President wanted me to convey his disappointment as well. In fact, more than disappointment. Concern. Deep concern over recent provocative actions by your country. I gesture down to the backyard. He nods. We start to walk into the backyard. The tent, yes, he says. Appropriate for this conversation. The black tent has no door, no zipper, only heavy overlapping flaps on the front. I put my hands together and slide them through, divide the flaps, and enter, as Prime Minister Volkov follows. Inside, all outside light is blocked out, the only illumination provided by artificial kerosene lamps in the corners. A small wooden table and chairs have been set up, as if a picnic were planned, but I make no move for them. For this conversation, just the two of us, just me and a man reported to be responsible for the savage butchering of innocent civilians, a man representing a country that may well be behind this terrifying attack on my country. I prefer to stand. President Chernikov has been quite alarmed at your provocative military actions of the last 36 hours, he says. With his thick accent, the words drip from his tongue, particularly provocative. Just training missions, I say. A sour smile passes and fades from his lips. Training missions, he says, the words bitter on his tongue. Just as in 2014. In 2014, after Russia invaded Ukraine, the United States sent two B-2 stealth bombers to Europe for training missions. The message was clear enough. Just like that, yes, I say. But far more extensive, he says. The movement of aircraft carriers and nuclear-armed submarines into the North Sea. Your stealth aircraft exercises over Germany. And, of course, the joint military exercises in Latvia and Poland. Two former Warsaw Pact countries, now members of NATO, one of them Latvia, sharing a border with Russia, and the other Poland, not far away on Belarus's southwestern flank. Including a simulated nuclear strike, he adds. Russia has done the same thing recently, I note. Not within 50 miles of your borders. His jaw muscles clench, squaring off his face. There is a challenge in his words, but there is fear, too. The fear is real. Neither of us wants war. Neither of us will win. The question is always, how far are we willing to be pushed? That's why we must be so careful about drawing lines in the sand. If those lines are crossed and we do nothing, we lose credibility. If they are crossed and we respond, well, that response is the war that neither of us wants. Mr. Prime Minister, I say, you know the reason I invited you, the virus. He blinks, his thick eyebrows bend, as if surprised at the segue, but that's a feint. He knows one thing follows the other. We discovered the presence of the virus about 2 weeks ago, I say, and when we did, the first thing that occurred to us was our vulnerability to a military attack. If the virus were to disable our military effectiveness, we would be open to an attack. So, Mr. Prime Minister, we immediately did two things. The first thing we did was recreate our continental systems here at home. We basically started over. Call it reinventing the wheel, reverse engineering, whatever you like. We've rebuilt our operational systems, disconnected from any device that could possibly be infected by the virus. New servers, new computers, everything new. We started with the things that mattered the most, our strategic defense systems, our nuclear fleet, and made sure that they were recreated free of any virus. And then we went from there. I'm happy to report, Mr. Prime Minister, that we have successfully completed that operation. It took us every second of these 2 weeks, but we did it. We have rebuilt our entire military operational infrastructure in the continental United States. We built those systems the first time around, after all, so it wasn't as hard as you might think to recreate them. Volkov is stoic, taking this in. He doesn't trust me any more than I trust him. We didn't publicize any of this work.
Our recreation of our military infrastructure was done, for obvious reasons, in utter secrecy. From his perspective, I might be bluffing. He can't confirm anything, I've just told him. So now we're going to talk about something he can confirm. The second thing we did simultaneously, I say, was make sure we disconnected our overseas military infrastructure from anything stateside. The same kind of reverse engineering. The long and short of it is, any computerized systems in our European arsenal that depended on our continental infrastructure, well, we replaced them with new systems. We made them independent. We wanted to make sure that if all our systems in the United States crashed, if all our computers went kaput. Something seems to dim in Volkov's eyes. He blinks and looks away, but then quickly returns his eyes to mine. We wanted to make sure, Mr. Prime Minister, I say, that even if someone utterly and completely destroyed our stateside military operational systems, we were armed and ready with our European resources, that we were prepared to respond militarily against any nation responsible for the virus, or any nation that had the ridiculous idea that it could take advantage of the United States during that difficult time by, say, attacking us. So clearly, these European training exercises were necessary, I say. And the good news is, they all have been successful. You probably already know that. The color in his face changes. He does know that. The Russians obviously closely followed our training exercises, but he's not going to give me the satisfaction of acknowledging that fact. The truth? There was only so much we could accomplish in 2 weeks. Only our generals know how thin and provisional these new systems are, how rudimentary compared to our existing systems. But they assure me they are effective and secure. Commands will go through. Missiles will fire. Targets will be hit. We now have full confidence, I continue, that even if somehow the virus still managed to infect our stateside operational network, we have the full capacity to engage in warfare of any kind. Nuclear, air, conventional, what have you, from our NATO bases in Europe. Anyone responsible for this virus, Mr. Prime Minister, or any nation that tries to take advantage of this difficult time to attack the United States or its allies, we reserve the right, and we will have the full capacity to respond with overwhelming force. So it's nothing specific to Russia. It just so happens that many of our NATO allies happen to be in your backyard. Right? I say, drawing it out, in your backyard. Volkov's eyebrows flare a bit with that reminder. The expansion of NATO to the Russian borders, as Noya pointed out, has been the cause of great consternation in the Kremlin. But if Russia has nothing to do with this virus, as President Chernikov has assured us, and as long as Russia makes no attempt to take advantage of us, Russia has nothing to worry about. I wave a hand. Nothing at all. He nods slowly. Some of the vinegar in his expression lost now. I'll say it to anyone, I say. Whoever is responsible for this virus, we will find out who did this. And if that virus detonates, we will consider it an act of war. Volkov is still nodding, his Adam's apple bobbing as he swallows that down. We will not strike first, Mr. Prime Minister. This is my solemn vow. But if we are struck, we will strike back. I put my hand on the Prime Minister's shoulder, so please relay that to President Chernikov, and please convey to him that I hope he's feeling better. I lean into him. And then, let's see if you can help us stop that virus, I say. Chapter 63. Noya Baram and I stand on the dock looking at the lake, the midday sun gaining ground in the sky, its beams reflecting off the shimmering water, the serenity and beauty of the scene grotesquely contrasted with the feeling of impending doom taking up residence in my gut. Not since Kennedy stared down Khrushchev over the missiles in Cuba has our nation been this close to world war. I've done it now. I've drawn the line in the sand. Now they know our military structure is operational, the virus notwithstanding.
And now they know that if they planted this virus and it detonates, the United States will consider it a first strike and respond accordingly. One of my Secret Service agents stands near the dock with one member each of the security details from Germany and Israel. About 50 yards from the shore, three men sit in a gray 25-foot motorboat, two of them lazily holding fishing rods for show, though they are not there to catch largemouth bass or catfish. All three are Secret Service, men without young children at my insistence. Their boat is a Defender-class Charlie boat used by Homeland Security and the Coast Guard. This one recently taken out of rotation at Guantanamo Bay and snatched up by Secret Service. Now it looks pretty much like an ordinary motorboat, but that's because it's impossible to tell that its updated hull is armored and bulletproof. The agents have thrown tarps over the machine guns mounted on the port and starboard sides by the cabin, as well as the 50-caliber machine gun on the bow. They are on a small bay of water that feeds into the larger man-made reservoir, staying close to the narrow opening that protects this private bay from the rest of the lake. I look back up the trail towards the cabin, toward the black tent on the lawn. Volkoff has been in and out of that tent so many times you'd think he was going for a merit badge. For the last 3 hours, Volkoff has been repeatedly summoned by Moscow for more phone calls, sending him back into the tent.
It means he believed you, Noya says.
Oh, they believe we're capable of a counterstrike, I say. Those training exercises left no doubt. Do they believe I'll actually do it? That's another question. Instinctively, I brush my hand against the wallet in my pocket, which holds the nuclear codes. Noya turns and looks at me.
Do you believe you'll do it?
That's the million-dollar question. What would you do, Noya? She moans.
Imagine if the virus detonates, she says. Economic collapse, panic, mass hysteria. In the midst of that, do you send troops to Russia? Do you launch nuclear missiles at Moscow?
They'd respond in kind, I say.
Yes. So not only are you facing unprecedented domestic problems, but millions of Americans are also exposed to nuclear radiation. Could your nation survive all that at once?
I put my hands on my knees, an old habit when I'm nervous from my days on the baseball mound.
But the flip side of the coin, she says, is how do you not respond? What will become of the United States if there is no retaliation? You must retaliate in some way, yes?
I find a stone in the grass, pick it up, and hurl it into the lake. I had a live fastball. It occurs to me that if I hadn't trashed my shoulder falling out of a Black Hawk helicopter in Iraq, I wouldn't be here right now. The United States will retaliate, I say. There's no scenario in which we don't retaliate. She says,
your Joint Chiefs prefer a conventional war, I assume.
Of course they do. A nuclear war is a lose-lose proposition. You only launch if you have no choice, because the other side launched first. That's why nobody has triggered that option. Mutually assured destruction has worked for a reason.
But a ground invasion of Russia, she says, even if your NATO allies join in, it will be long and bloody.
We'd win, I say, eventually. But then what would Chernikov do? He'd use nuclear weapons, that's what he'd do. If his back was against the wall, if he was going to be ousted, he'd have nothing to lose. He cares more about his own ass than his people.
So you're right back at a nuclear holocaust.
Right. We'd lose thousands of men and women on the Russian battlefield, and then he launches nukes anyway. Noya is quiet. What can she say? Okay, well, I throw up my hands. None of that is an option. The only option is stopping that goddamn virus and not having to make that decision.
And you've done what you can, Johnny. You've given Russia every reason to want to help you.
I rub my face with my hands as if I can cleanse away the stress. Well, that was the point of my threat. I gesture up the path toward the cabin. Volkoff still in the black tent, communicating back home.
I hope they're taking the message seriously.
Assuming it's Russia, she reminds me. We don't know this for certain. How is China responding to the Japanese exercises?
We just did essentially the same thing in Japan that we did in Europe. The air exercises and the nuclear simulation. Beijing wasn't happy.